This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 27th of January, these are our main stories. Chinese health officials say the countryside is a weak point for controlling the new coronavirus. In a bid to contain the outbreak, the New Year holidays have been extended and group gatherings have been discouraged. A passenger plane has crashed in central Afghanistan in an area under Taliban control. Also in this podcast, on the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp, survivors remember what happened to them there.
You came in and you had a very funny taste in your mouth, a sort of sweet and sticky. And that was from burning all these people.
And a Cape Town mother tells the heart-rending story of how her life was turned upside down after she gave evidence against a gang.
If I want to die, I want you as my child to carry this message that my mother stood for truth and justice for all of humanity.
But we begin in China, where the authorities are massively stepping up efforts to try to contain the new coronavirus, which has now spread to almost every area of the country. The celebration period for the Lunar New Year holiday has been extended until next Monday in an attempt to stop people from traveling on public transport and further spreading the respiratory disease. Most of the at least 80 deaths so far have occurred in the city of Wuhan in Hubei province, but China's National Health Commission says well over 400 more are critically ill, and it estimates that there are nearly 6,000 people infected within China. Speaking at a news conference in Beijing, Feng Luxia, who's with China's Center for Disease Control and Prevention, urged anyone who's been in Wuhan, the city at the center of the outbreak, to stay indoors.
All residents should actively cooperate with the prevention and control investigation work of our communities, especially people with a travel history or residential history in Wuhan within the last 2 weeks. Firstly, they should as soon as possible register at the community or village where they are. Reduce outside activities, especially places where people are crowded together, public spaces.
He went on to say that anyone who had recently returned from Wuhan should monitor their own health and take the following steps.
They must conduct health tests on their own every day, measure their temperature twice a day, and if the conditions allow, try to live alone in a ventilated and single room and reduce contact with family members.
Our correspondent Robin Brandt is in Shanghai. I asked him how confident the Chinese authorities were that they could keep the epidemic under control.
At this stage, I think the truth is they're not sure. And the most significant measure we've seen today on a national level is a move by the government in Beijing to extend the Chinese Lunar New Year for a further 3 days. So people will not be returning to their homes or their workplaces until at the very earliest next Monday. Because the reality is, just as we have experts here saying that the severity of this type of coronavirus is increasing and President Xi Jinping is warning of a grave challenge ahead, about 500 million people were about to start getting on trains and planes and into cars over the coming 24-48 hours and leave their family holiday and return to where they live or where they work. And of course, the prospect of that just adds to the nightmare scenario for the government, because that is a huge number of people once again crisscrossing the country and once again increasing the likelihood of this virus spreading. So the holiday has been extended and the authorities will hope that gives them some time to continue with their efforts of containment.
And beyond the concerns, the very serious concerns about the health of people, there's also a great deal of concern, obviously, about the Chinese economy and the knock-on effects on it.
Yes, I mean, we're seeing moves by big companies here, Alibaba, Tencent, big tech and retail companies, to encourage their staff to stay at home over the next couple of weeks. The Shanghai government, the people in charge of the city from where I'm speaking to you from at the moment, ordered all enterprises, all business essentially, apart from essential business, to shut down for a period up to February the 7th. Schools will be closed until February the 14th. So this city, China's largest city, 24 million million people will essentially come to a halt over the next 10 to 14 days. And that gives you an idea of the scale of the measures the government is putting in place, but also the impact it's going to have on people's daily lives and, of course, on the economy of this country, an economy already trying to deal with a slowdown in growth and a fall in GDP.
Robin Brandt, although most of the cases of the new coronavirus have occurred inside China, according to the World Health Organization, there have been 44 elsewhere. Most have been in other Asian countries such as Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore and South Korea, and several in Australia and the US. So how are other countries coping with the outbreak? Our health correspondent Michelle Roberts told me more.
Many countries now are advising against travel to the most problematic area, which is Hubei province in China. Singapore's gone a step further, saying that any travel to China is not advised. And Mongolia has actually closed its border. So different countries are taking different approaches, but all of them are trying to contain this virus, which can spread by respiratory droplets. So it's really difficult because even people who haven't got symptoms yet might be contagious. That's what the experts are saying. So although you can screen at airports, you can close borders, you can try and get people to stop mixing with each other, really, it's really hard to contain this type of thing.
And how hard is it to stop it from spreading beyond China?
Well, we've already heard of these 44 cases elsewhere. So it's in Europe, it's in North America, it's in Australasia. We have heard about the Ivory Coast, where they are testing a patient there as well to see if they've got it. So that would be Africa as well, if that is positive. The infection period, we think, is about 14 days. So really, you've got to stop any contact with somebody who had this infection and still might be infectious. It's too soon to know when we could see an end to this. We will see more cases. It's going to keep spreading for a while yet.
Michelle Roberts, a passenger plane has crashed in central Afghanistan in an area under Taliban control. But there's a mystery over who owned the plane and possible casualties. Our South Asia regional editor, Barasan Etherajan, filled me in on what we're hearing so far and what we're trying to find out.
There are conflicting reports about this reported plane crash in the central Ghazni province. What the local officials are saying is that a plane has crashed and it caught fire and immediately and there were no survivors. These were attributed to the local officials. Initially, people thought it could be one of the civilian aircraft carrying passengers within Afghanistan, but the state-run airline immediately came out and said two scheduled flights. They were going to Kabul and Delhi, the Indian capital. They both landed safely, so they denied any reports. And then there are some suspicions it could be a foreign aircraft, and there is a lot of speculation on the social media whether it could be any military plane, because there are international troops in Afghanistan, and also lots of flights cross Afghanistan while going to countries like India. So there are lots of speculations, but we still don't know whether this plane belongs to any private company or whether it is a military aircraft. We are still waiting for the details. But the Taliban, they sent a message saying that they are also searching that area for the plane crash.
And Barasan Etherajan, commemorations are taking place in Auschwitz to mark the day 75 years ago that the Soviet army liberated the Nazi concentration camp. More than a million men, women and children, the vast majority of them Jewish, but also Roma people and homosexuals, were killed in gas chambers. About 200 survivors will be attending, among them Jeanette Spiegel, who arrived at the camp at the age of 20.
For the first, you came in and you had a very funny taste in your mouth. It was sweet, or sort of sweet and sticky, and that was from burning all these people, but we didn't know them when we came in.
The BBC's Adam Easton is in Auschwitz.
This morning we had some of the former prisoners and the Polish president, Leigh Reeves, at the Auschwitz main camp with its infamous sign, Arbeit macht frei, the lie, of course, work sets you free. They laid Reeves at the Wall of Death, as it's known, which was where prisoners were executed with a single shot in Auschwitz. There's going to be a solemn ceremony at Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is 3 kilometres away, the massive site where the Nazis built the crematoria and gas chamber, 4 of them, to carry out the systematic murder of Europe's Jews, and the leaders from 50 countries will hear four Auschwitz survivors tell their stories before there will be ecumenical prayers, and leaders will, with the prisoners, will walk along the train tracks where the cattle cars brought the people from all over Europe, and there was the selection of who was to work and who was to go to the gas chambers. There's a memorial at the end of those train tracks, and people will be lighted candles at that memorial to remember the 1.1 million people who were murdered at this camp.
And Adam, there were very few survivors still left, so these kinds of testimonies will probably be the last we'll be able to hear firsthand.
That's right. I mean, it's very enormous courage it takes for survivors to come back. There's only 200 now. There was 300 5 years ago. There was 1,500 15 years ago. But they say they must come to this place of such horror because they must tell their story. 91-year-old Benjamin Lesser will be among them. He's come from the United States. He was a 15-year-old boy when he was deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau from Hungary. And he remembers coming to Birkenau and staying in the barracks that first night with the screams all night, he said, because the barrack was located next to a pit which was on fire. And because there were so many people in the summer of 1944 who were coming from Hungary to be gassed and burnt in the crematoria, there was too many people and wasn't enough capacity. So they burnt people in these pits. Sometimes the Nazis were throwing infants into the pit alive, he said. He could hear their screams. But he said he has to come back to tell that to people because, as he says, it's human nature to forget the bad times. And this place, Auschwitz as it exists today, is a message for future generations not to target people because of different religions or different faiths or different creeds or different nationalities. Because as we hear, anti-Semitic incidents are on the rise all over the world, and this is a lesson that needs to be heard again and again.
Adam Easton from the site of the former Nazi concentration camp, Auschwitz. Still to come in this podcast.
Tonight is for Kobe. I'm crying 'cause I love you.
The Grammy Awards in Los Angeles are dominated by stars paying tribute to basketball legend Kobe Bryant, who's died aged 41. And Jamaica calls on richer countries around the world to help the poorer ones whose tourism is threatened by climate change. In Italy, the far-right leader Matteo Salvini was hoping that success for his League party in regional elections would deliver a mortal blow to the national coalition government. But in the end, after a major political mobilization of opponents, including what's known as the Sardines movement, the centre-left Democratic Party held off the challenge. Mr. Salvini and his centre-right allies were successful, however, in the southern province of Calabria, taking control from the left. Our Rome correspondent, Mark Lowen, has the details.
It looked like it was going to be neck and neck going into this election, and the fear in the left bloc was that if they were going to lose this region, which they had governed since the Second World War, it's the region which is home to Ferrari, Lamborghini, Parmesan cheese, Bologna, then that could have placed unbearable pressure on the coalition government, of which the left is part, and it could have led to fresh elections, which Matteo Salvini, the far-right leader here, would be projected to win and become Italy's first far-right populist prime minister. In the event, what happened was that there was a mass mobilisation of voters. Turnout was about double what it was in the last regional election, and the left has held on to this region with more than 50% of the vote. So I think that it was partly the popularity of the centre-left governor, who is very competent, who campaigned very much on local issues. He is very liked in the region. It was partly this massive mobilisation by the street movement that sprung up 2 months ago called the Sardines, called thus because its members pack squares right across this country, and since it burst onto the scene 2 months ago, it has filled piazzas right across Italy with tens of thousands of people in an anti-Salvini movement, saying that Matteo Salvini represents hatred and discrimination and the echoes of Italy's dark past, with a return to fascist ideology and even sort of evocation of Mussolini. He, of course, rejects that. He said that he is simply standing up for Italians first. And even though Salvini has not won this election, this regional election, he is still, you know, a dynamic, very, very dynamic force in Italian politics.
Mark Lewin in Rome. The death of the basketball legend Kobe Bryant is being mourned around the world. He and his daughter were among 9 people killed in a helicopter crash yesterday in the city of Calabasas in California. Bryant, who was 41, retired in 2016 after a 20-year career with the LA Lakers and was named an NBA All-Star 18 times. Politicians, celebrities and sports stars have been paying tribute, including his former teammate Shaquille O'Neal, who posted this emotional video on Twitter.
It's very difficult for me to put in words how I feel about the loss of Kobe Bryant. He was one of the first ones to leave high school and come into the NBA and do so well, dominating the game. I had the privilege of being there when he scored his 81-point game, and it was something that I will always remember as one of the highlights of the things that I have learned and observed in sports. Rest in peace, young man. This loss is, it's just hard to comprehend.
Shaquille O'Neal. Kobe Bryant played his entire career at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, which last night hosted the 62nd annual Grammy Awards. The 18-year-old singer-songwriter Billie Eilish won in all 4 major categories at the ceremony, including Record and Album of the Year. From LA, Sophie Long reports.
Tonight is for Kobe.
Top-nominated breakout star Lizzo launched the show with a tribute to Kobe Bryant before singing 2 of her aptly named tracks, 'Cause I Love You and Truth Hurts. It set the tone for the evening as host Alicia Keys continued the tributes.
And we're literally standing here, heartbroken, in the house that Kobe Bryant built.
As the audience wiped away tears outside Staples Center, the outpouring of grief grew as the thousands of people who gathered to pay tribute to the basketball star chanted his name.
Kobe! 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 Kobe!
Bad Guy by Billy English.
Inside, siblings Billie Eilish and Phineas owned the evening, together taking home 11 golden statues for When We Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, the album they created in a small bedroom in their LA home.
I feel like I joke around a lot and I never take anything seriously at these kind of things, but I genuinely want to say I'm so grateful, and I only want to say that I'm grateful and that I'm so honored to be here amongst all of you. I love you to my core. I grew up watching all of you. Thank you to my team, my mom, my dad.
You know, we just make music in a bedroom together. We still do that, and they let us do that. And I just, this is to all of the kids who are making music in their bedroom today. You're going to get one of these.
And the Grammy goes to...
Lizzo won 3 honors.
Lizzo! Lizzo!
Including the best pop solo performance for Truth Hurts.
You guys create connectivity, and as I'm speaking to all of y'all in this room, we need to continue to reach out. This is the beginning of making music that moves people again, making music that feels good, that liberates people. Yes.
The awards come at a time of huge turmoil behind the scenes, with accusations of bullying, sexism, and voting irregularities swirling around the Recording Academy.
What's happening?
But no one knows how to put on a spectacular quite like they do.
Two for the show.
Please welcome the amazing Lil Nas X, everybody.
The genre-busting performances continued from Lil Nas X and Billy Ray Cyrus, who won Best Music Video for Old Town Road.
Can't nobody tell me nothing.
They were joined on stage by BTS, the first Korean band to play at the Grammys, for a memorable rendition of the number one hit.
Sophie Long from the Grammys in Los Angeles. What do you do if your economy depends heavily on tourism and is being threatened by climate change? Holidaymakers to the golden beaches of the Caribbean bring in huge amounts of money, but now some of those beaches are disappearing due to rising water levels and effect of global warming. So the government of Jamaica is calling on countries around the world to set up what it calls a global resilience fund aimed at providing relief to tourism-dependent countries and communities affected by climate change. The Jamaican tourism minister is Edmund Bartlett. He came into the BBC to talk to my colleague Paul Hawkins and told him about the impact of climate change on his country.
Elevated water levels. We're losing beaches. Extreme weather conditions are now prevailing. So there's a higher level of drought that is taking place.
Even with hurricanes, because the hurricane season lasts.
That's correct. Great. But therein lies the extreme weather situation, because now you're getting hurricanes that are far more intense with greater ferocity of winds that we've not seen before. And that's why the fund discussion is appropriate.
Well, the fund will pay for things like that.
It will, first of all, help to educate and to give public information and knowledge about how to deal with, how to track, how to mitigate, how to manage, how to respond and recover quickly, but most importantly, how to grow after recovery. Because most countries recover and then they are thrown back 20, 30 years in time. Mm. And the recovery process, the growth process afterwards is slow and anemic.
How much do you think you need in the fund to make this work?
Well, you know, it's a tall call. We're looking at now the possibility of a pandemic in the sense of the coronavirus out of China. We don't know how far that will go, but we know what chikungunya did in the Caribbean, and we had a sense perhaps of what SARS did when that hit the world. We're finding it difficult to quantify at this time, but we know that it can be done.
We're talking about hundreds of millions.
But we're talking about a lot.
Who would be paying into this fund?
Well, I think that a fund like this would have to get its service from the public and private sector. So the private sector has a responsibility to look at what climate change means and how we are going to fund an arrangement to understand the changes, to mitigate, to manage and to recover. And the public said there will be governments.
Right, which governments?
All the governments. The bigger ones, of course, who have the greater impact on the global situation and whose footprints are larger.
And just finally, what's your message then for President Xi Jinping, for President Trump, for the big economy to the world?
Well, I would say that, look, we have a responsibility. And I think that to him who is given more is expected. And so the big countries of the world have a greater responsibility, not only because their footprints are larger, but also because it is with them that the drive to enable sustainability in the world resides. First of all, the resources required to deal with these issues, and then for the equity that must flow.
The Jamaican Tourism Minister, Edmund Bartlett. We end this podcast with the story of a brave woman from South Africa whose life was turned upside down when she witnessed a gang murder in the street where she lives. It's in the area of Cape Flats, a vast sprawl inland of Cape Town that feels a world away from the beaches, restaurants, and tourist sites often associated with the mountain. Rokshanda Pasco testified against the gang, but she now lives in a safe house with her kids and grandchildren after gang members threatened her. She told my colleague Claire McDonald about the day the killing took place.
So on that morning, few gunshots rang out and I went out to see, because why, our children is in school, and when we hear gunshots, we're always on alert. I then was informed by a neighbor that the rivalry gang shot at the gang leader. It means that our road is going to be flooded with gangs now. From two sides of the road, the gang came to our streets and they found this man in the street at the shop, and they started assaulting him, stabbing him. Even up till today, the sounds of how people screamed, it was about between 50 and 100 gang members on this one man, and all was hitting, beating and stabbing.
You witnessed this horrific event and decided to be a witness in this case against this gang member. That's a very brave thing to do. Why did you decide to do that?
So in my community and mostly on the Cape Flats, a lot of people are very afraid. And I'm one of those people that always questioned when a murder happened, why is people silent? Why are they not speaking up?
So you decided to testify. Tell us how they tried to put you off.
The night before I had to go and testify, I received a message that they're going to kill me. That same night, 11:45, two guys came and they started shooting at my house. One was standing outside and the other one jumped over the gate and confronted my son with a gun, emptying a 16-shooter at my son and his family, traumatizing my whole family, shot right through my house. And the worst for me was having to hear my children's screams and my grandchildren's screams.
Despite that gun attack, you went ahead. There were convictions in this case, weren't there?
Yes, there were convictions. Even before the trial had started, they have tried to buy out witnesses, and they did buy out the other witness. So the threats intensified, it became worse. And then they expected me in the trial. As you know, the shooting transpired at my house. Then they threatened to say if I do not step back, they will come for one of my children.
Has it been worth it? Do you still think that you made the right decision?
My son is still struggling with sleeping disorder, can't sleep. And I think the constant nightmares, I still feel I've made the right decision. My youngest daughter woke up yesterday and she looked with big eyes at me and she said, I just dreamed and saw how they killed you. And the one thing I said to her, when I took the decision to take the stand, I knew it could go both ways. But I know, and I'm not going to die as a coward. I'm not going to die as a sellout on our people. If I want to die, I want you as my child to carry this message that my mother stood for truth and justice for all of humanity.
Rokshanda Pasco, we approached the South African police for a response and we're still waiting. And that's almost all from us for now. But before we go, here's an update on that mysterious plane crash in Afghanistan we told you about earlier. Video and photographs posted on social media suggest that the plane that crashed in the central Afghan province of Ghazni belonged to the U.S. Air Force. The Air Force logo can clearly be seen on the fuselage. Local media reports suggested that more than 80 people were on board, but Afghan police say there's no information about casualties. There'll be more on that story in the next edition of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.